from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
I keep coming back from Lowell.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Lyle Dudley? What y'all think? Lyle has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at LyleDudley.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And what about our set back here? What do y'all think about our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, we're stepping back in time as our writers recount teenage tales of angst, mischief, and growing pains. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Dina Nall plans revenge in only the way a jilted teenage girl can. And we'll end the night with Leslie Hitt trying her teenage best to get out of doing something she really doesn't want to do. But let's start the night with Jill Bales as she struggles to fit in with the cool crowd and ends up filling out in It Melts in Your Mouth, Not in Your Hands. The concession stand at Henderson State's Haygood Field, where the Arkadelphia Badgers played their home games, wasn't a Chinese sweatshop, but after spending 16 years in air-conditioned entitlement, you couldn't convince me of that. At least sweatshop workers got to sit down, not us. We stood for hours in this sultry, narrow strip of chaos where drinks were spilled, change had to be counted out constantly, and the Neanderthal-era popcorn machine was as stubborn as a sulking toddler. I was junior class president, and this was my kingdom. Jill, why won't the fountain spray Coke? We keep getting foam over here. Jill, where do we keep the paper towels? There's a huge mess over here. While the rest of the high school crowd spent moonlit Friday nights cheering the Badgers on to their best season ever, I was getting grease stains on my tattered work shirt and dodging other sweaty bodies as we furiously filled unceasing demands for caffeine, chocolate, and cheese sauce. Hey, girl. It was Majorette Barbara. Taking her turn at the counter in a sparkling sequined one-piece and white go-go boots. Her long brunette hair was as sleek and straight as the fur on a cat. She flipped it back over her shoulder and flashed white teeth at me, indulgently. We need a ton of Cokes down there, she said. We've been yelling so much we're dying of thirst. What's the score, I asked, just as a crowd below roared. Barbara jerked her head towards the field. Oh, man, I bet Trent just made another touchdown, and I'm missing it. She twirled back around to face me. Can't you hurry it up? 3 summers earlier, when my father was transferred to Arkadelphia, and we were moving into our practically treeless subdivision, Barbara and two other neighborhood girls came knocking on our door, eager to check out the newest eighth grader at L.M. Goza Junior High. They were met by a shy, bespectacled metal mouth with acne, frizzy hair, and weight issues. Jill, they said when they left 15 minutes later, "We'll get together before school starts." The next time I saw them, it was in L.M. Goza's large auditorium, where all the brown baggers gathered at noon and sat in clusters according to status while they ate their tuna sandwiches. Way in the back, the group who had better things to do than worry about the pecking order went about their business blissfully unconcerned about their coolness rankings. Those at the top, the same ones who'd come calling that summer, sat fittingly on top of the auditorium stage and dangled their legs over the edge while they playfully flirted and shouted and mauled one another. And those who yearned, like me, to experience their effortless confidence and charisma sat on the floor directly in front of them, dutifully making small talk about fractions homework or that morning's pop quiz about the Louisiana Purchase, while our eyes wandered over to the stage and lingered. I had to get up there. By my sophomore year of high school, I'd taped a list to my bathroom mirror: lose 20 pounds, stop biting nails, let hair grow out like Kate Jackson's. I didn't dare hope for Farrah's. Get braces off, get mother and daddy to let me have contacts. Gradually, a steady stream of Melba toast, Jell-O, and cottage cheese whittled the pounds away, and with a shock, I realized that I had collarbones. "Jill, you've lost so much weight," Barbara said. "Come eat lunch with us." "Jill, you should be a class officer," Mona said. "We'd vote for you." So that May, I ran for junior class president. My winning campaign, heavy on the male vote, may have been helped by the construction paper buttons I naively handed out: "Jill will." But by midsummer, when the stage girls didn't call and the days melted into a forgettable stream of game shows, Reader's Digest condensed novels, and intermittent babysitting jobs, Jill's will wasn't enough to keep me on the Jell-O diet. Bored and disillusioned, I began peeking between the covers of my mother's Joy of Cooking. There I discovered the Bugs Bunny recipe that would taunt my Elmer Fudd life: oatmeal, cookies, cocaine. I had no clue what cocaine meant. It sounded French, or better yet, kind of naughty. The cookies were crunchy, melt-in-your-mouth nuggets of desire, and the batter was even better, a not-too-sweet bowl of buttery creaminess. With my mother's ancient beige Sunbeam mixer whirring away, I cleaned off the spatula constantly, finger to mouth. If the health department had known, they would have hauled me off immediately. Now, by football season, and with the concession stand in full swing, my collarbones were long gone. I pushed Barbara's tray of Cokes across the counter to her. "Hey," she said before she left, "let me go on and have a bag of M&Ms too, okay?" She stood there in all of her shimmering, confident glory, her exposed thighs not inducing an ounce of body issues or candy guilt. I reached down to pull out a bag for her and was confronted with the fact that the box was almost empty. With a surge of shame and guilt, I shoved it back under the counter and looked around. Nobody saw. When the game was over and the stage kids had piled into their Trans Ams and Grand Prix and roared off to Sonic or Pizza Hut to continue celebrating, we floor dwellers stayed to empty oil out of the popcorn machine and mop up the sticky floor. My mother arrived in her Buick to help load the candy bar boxes into the trunk, and we headed home to stack them in a corner of my pink gingham bedroom where they would stay until the next home game. "How'd it go, honey?" she asked as we left the stadium. "Busy as last week?" "Busier," I said. "That's because you're so great at this. You're such a leader. You should go into politics." "The team's just good this year," I said. She didn't hear me. "I'm serious. You could be in the state legislature or Congress. Women are doing it now. Look at Pat Schroeder." I could feel my throat tighten. At the moment, I didn't want to be a feminist congresswoman. I just wanted to date to the prom, and not one set up by a pitying teacher and one of her eager-to-please male students, either. The next night, I switched on my bedroom's black and white television, as I did every Saturday, to watch The Love Boat. And to stare at my private concession stand in the corner. Nobody can see. So I dropped 2 coins into the nearby money box, pulled out a package of M&Ms, ripped off the top, and held it over my open mouth. Then I pinched the wrapper until I transformed it into a paper shotgun. And I fired 1 candy-coated shell at a time. Blue, brown, green, yellow, and orange, into its waiting target. Then I reloaded with another bag, and another, and another. This was shooting up. Melt in your mouth style. And this, too, was my kingdom.
Jill Bales did graduate from Arkadelphia Senior High and went on to get a degree in history from Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas. Ironically enough, and after much therapy, she now coordinates food drives for the Arkansas Food Bank. In our next story, Dina Nall is bored on a weeknight and decides that teenage mischief is better than boredom in Revenge is Best Served Green.
Mallory and I were bored. It was a weeknight during Christmas break, and we sat at her table discussing the options that might be available to 2 seniors in high school on a Tuesday night. A movie? There was nothing we wanted to see. Driving up and down the drag in Mallory's new black Firebird? No one would be out on a Tuesday night, and we would look desperate cruising an empty street. We wanted to do something exciting. But what? We sat in pathetic silence. "Well," Mallory said, "there's Michelle." Michelle. The very name caused my stomach to tense and my eyes to narrow. Michelle was my ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend. Jason and I had dated for 2 years and had recently broken up, which was a good thing. But then he met Michelle. Michelle was younger and shorter than me, and she worked at Sonic. That's basically all I knew about her until she called me one day to let me know that she and Jason were now together and that he was completely over me. That was months earlier, and I was still mad about it. And this empty, boring Tuesday night was calling for a little something I like to call revenge. Mallory and I decided to do something obnoxious to Michelle, but not destructive. Nothing that would really get us in trouble. Her car was our best target. We could do something messy but non-destructive to her car and make a quick escape. No one would know who had done it. Mallory disappeared into her mother's walk-in pantry and soon emerged with a big smile and a jumbo Sam-sized can of spinach. We couldn't find her mother's can opener, so after sawing it open with a knife, we had a weapon ready to fire. The moonless night contributed to the darkness we needed to carry out our plan. We drove Mallory's car to Michelle Street, where Mallory switched off the headlights and we slowly rolled up to Michelle's house. Michelle's silver Honda Civic was parked in her driveway. We hopped out, dumped the entire can of spinach all over Michelle's trunk and back window, left the empty can in her driveway, hopped giggling into Mallory's Firebird, and sped away. As the thrill of the prank began to fade, the realization set in that someone actually could figure out that Mallory and I had done it, especially if we were seen together that night. So we decided to split up and pretend we hadn't seen each other all night, if anyone asked. Mallory dropped me off at my house, and she went home. I had been home only a few minutes when my phone rang. It was Jason. He was fuming. He knew Mallory and I were responsible. Did we really think we could get away with this? Didn't I know we had committed vandalism? Didn't I know Michelle's dad was a cop? Uh-oh. I emphatically told Jason that neither Mallory nor I would participate in something so obnoxious and immature as dumping spinach on someone's car. When his accusations continued, I told him he was delusional and hung up. We were in trouble. I frantically dialed Mallory's number. Jason called me, I told her. He thinks we did it. Mallory started to panic. We both wondered aloud if spinach could cause any actual damage to a car. Could it peel the paint off, cause permanent green streaks, eat through the metal frame? What are we going to do? Mallory wailed. Don't worry, I told her. I'll think of something. I hung up. I had to think of a way to get the two of us completely exonerated from this. Then genius struck. My parents weren't home. I went into the kitchen and opened the refrigerator. An egg? No, too obvious. I needed weird food like spinach. Then I spotted the cottage cheese container. Perfect! I grabbed it and a large spoon and ran out the front door into my Chevy Caprice parked in our driveway. I pried the lid off the container, scooped up a spoonful of the chunky white substance, and executed an impressive splat across the back window of my car. I stepped back and admired my work. Then I went inside, washed the spoon, and returned it and the cottage cheese to their designated places. I curled up on the couch, turned on the TV, and waited. After a while, my parents pulled into the driveway next to my car. They came rushing into the house. Dina, my mom said, there's something disgusting all over the back of your car. What? You have got to be kidding. I jumped up, ran out the door, and feigned shock and surprise as I surveyed the mess. My dad, feeling sorry for me, turned on the water spout and dragged the garden hose over to the back of my car. I'll clean this up for you, honey, he said. It's amazing what young people do to amuse themselves these days. I ran back inside and called Jason. You will never believe this, I said. Someone just threw cottage cheese all over the back of my car. Well, I didn't do it, he said. Ha! You expect me to believe that? He kept proclaiming his innocence and then fell silent. You know what I think happened? He asked. What? I said, still pretending to be annoyed. Oh, please let Mallory and me be off the hook. It sounds like someone knows that we used to date and they're just trying to mess with both of us, he said. That makes sense, I said, my voice softening. I'm sure that's it. We hung up and I looked out the front window at my dad rolling up the hose. I had always heard that revenge is best served cold. As it turns out, revenge can also be served green and leafy. I breathed a sigh of relief as I walked back to my room, hopped up on my bed, and dialed Mallory's number.
Believe it or not, Dina Nall is a minister's wife and a Sunday school teacher. Most days, she tries to be an upstanding, law-abiding citizen. A vegetarian for 5 years now, Dina prefers using spinach for food and not malicious intent. In our final story of the night, Leslie Hitt's teenage girly ways are challenged to the hilt, and then some in The Miler.
Not even the DeWitt Junior High Dragonettes, free throw champion of 1978, could get out of running in this track meet. The lineup before the start of the race was surreal. I knew that I didn't belong. I was trapped in some horrible Twilight Zone episode that wouldn't end in 30 minutes, in black and white. Now I would swear I was being punked. My father was there. He was the school superintendent and tried to make it to as many activities as he could. I was ashamed he had to see what was about to happen. So here's the deal. In genuine affection, I refer to my legs as hamster legs. Round, short, with ineffectual movement and little distance. In all fairness, and removing the likability factor, I probably would have been, and still would be, the last person picked for any team not involving cooking or playing the piano. I've never had a gazelle like Grace. I'm clumsy and the epitome of running like a girl, with the hands slightly out to the side, flapping for balance. Many have tried to duplicate this on the trampoline. Although endearing, it is not conducive to good ball handling skills. Unsurprisingly, I'm not an athlete. I used to hit the tennis ball with my now ex-husband. The Nike tennis skirts lose something in the translation from website to my size. Or maybe the harsh sunlight on the Lakewood tennis courts was unkind to us all. My footwork was, at best, described as lumbering, shuffling quickly up and back, then up and back again, misjudging the ball depth before swinging disappointingly, then trash talk incessantly when I got one past him. A brief and rare moment that was savored. I could feel my heart beat in both feet as the swelling commenced. It hurts to not be as cute as I think I am. So I occasionally walk the beagle. A tiny woman with two leash dogs once lapped me twice on the trail around the lake. In lieu of some mercy warning signal, my beagle bellowed each time. Probably from a mad desire to run off with a real athlete to catch some speed and feel his ears fly back. And as if I needed further proof, a large goose, who felt strongly I was questioning his authority to be in the middle of the road, chased us half a block on the way home. I shudder to think what that looked like to the poor, unsuspecting neighbors just trying to eat their dinner or read their mail. I can Zumba and attempt various yoga poses in the absolute sacrosanct privacy of my own home, as long as I don't catch a glimpse. If so, game over. Yet I dream of running while asleep and awake, just running and running without ever getting tired. The movement, the breeze I would make, the propelling forward motion that I like to believe came naturally to me as a child. I see people running down the street in the early morning, after work and in groups. They can actually talk to each other while they run. I marvel at that skill. I once told a friend that I don't believe in endorphins. They're just a made-up concept to get people to exercise. She informed me they are real. You know, like when you run for about an hour and a half and then you feel like you can keep running forever, that's endorphins. My sneer prompted a change of subject. In 1997, I accidentally started wogging, a cross between walking and jogging. I bought a treadmill, and with the proper sequence of music from my boombox, could last about 30 minutes. I would speed up during Van Halen and the Coneheads soundtrack and recover with Forrest Gump. I don't know what overcame me then. It was an accident, and even at the time, I knew it was not to be analyzed and overthought. Just continue the magic. And I did, for 3 months. A lumbering fall down a short flight of stairs broke my ankle and the spell. I want to find the spell again. Not crazy running down the street like John Candy in Stripes or anything. And Lord knows not in public. But maybe behind closed doors on a treadmill with a perfect music blasting through my iPod. So I was not your typical junior high basketball player. The hair was painstakingly rolled every night with bristle curlers, sprayed with water, then slept on gingerly. The nails were frosty pink, and the scent of Taboo and Love's Baby Soft swirled around me like Pig Pen's dirt cloud. The ball seemed to bounce higher and higher the more I dribbled it. The sheer possibility of a fast break was my worst nightmare. It was the last year of three-on-three basketball, and I had no intention of moving into full court action. I liked my offense and defense lines clearly drawn, thanks. Coach Horton had little patience for my antics. When I cried and begged him to take me out of the meet lineup, he snarled, "Leslie, get on the bus." All of the girl basketball players had to run track in the spring. It wasn't negotiable. No, not even if I mopped the gym floor or paid him in quarters earned from progressing to the next song in the Schirmer piano primer. He just didn't understand. I calmly explained the situation. I hated the mile warm-up so badly that I rushed from algebra, threw on the tube socks and DJHS athletic shorts, and started the trek a good 10 minutes earlier than everyone else. Down the road, curve through the fairgrounds, wash the gravel, don't think about snakes. I would get passed by some of the real athletes without even a glance or a curt left. But somehow he missed all of this and just noticed the albeit whimpering, finish, with his arms crossed across his chest, his legs in the wide coach stance. I wonder if he thought I had an alter ego that could barely limp up and down the basketball court but flew like Flojo around the fairgrounds every day. On this ill-dated fay of the meet, I prayed for rain. And although it was overcast, the god of my understanding had a wicked sense of humor. The dread was stifling. On the bus ride over, I was so upset, I scratched off my fingernail polish. Because I never had any direction on pacing, or because I ignored any direction on the grounds it was a non-issue, I shot out of the starting line like it would end in 40 yards or less. I just wanted it to be over. The sooner I could finish, the sooner it would be over. Less than halfway through the first lap, the magnitude of my error was obvious. My lungs burned, and I thought I might die. Then I came to the realization that I wasn't going to die, and that was much, much worse. I've been told I was half crying most of the race and frantically looking behind me at intervals. I wonder why. Did I think someone was coming to get me or to save me? There was no Chariots of Fire theme playing in the background for me. In fact, if this event had a theme song, it would probably have been Oh Yeah from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I'm pretty sure it would have been in slow motion. Yet my hamster legs kept pumping slowly and painfully. I saw the final stretch and saw there was actually an end. And from somewhere deep in a soul I didn't yet know existed, I sprinted to the finish line and kept sprinting into the grassy middle area where I violently vomited into my long blonde hair on my hands and knees, onto my scratched off fingernail polish, still smelling faintly of Taboo and Baby Soft. But I'm happy to report that I did not come in dead last. Well, not to me anyway. The other poor soul that had no business running that race had dropped out after the first lap. Now, she truly came in last, in my opinion. She was not a miler.
Leslie Hitt lives in Fayetteville, Arkansas, where she works for UAMS Northwest. Her background includes accounting, video production, mall leasing, and higher education. She is currently working on a sitcom screenplay about the shopping mall world, as well as continuing to write about a life that is too rich to be fiction. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.